Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome, everyone. This is a new episode of the New Books Network. My name is Sarah Vogelsanger, and I'm your host today. I'm here with Hamza Mucine, a researcher of the Transnational Institute based in UK, and we will be talking about his newly published book, Dismantling Green Colonialism and Energy and Climate Justice in the Arab Region, co-edited by Katie Sandwell. The book was published by Pluto Press last year in 2023, so it is a very new book. In this podcast, we will talk about climate change and neocolonial activities in the Middle Eastern and North African region. To begin with, I want to cite the subtitle of the introduction, which is Just in Time, the Urgent Need for Just Transition in the Arab Region. This is, in my point of view, a very well-written start in this very insightful and well-written book. Welcome, Hamza. Very excited to talk to you today and hear more about your book and its background. How are you?
Good. Really looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you. So first of all, I'm interested in hearing more about the book and its background, and specifically also about you. Can you maybe introduce yourself and tell us about how you became a researcher and what made you an activist in climate justice?
So my name is Hamza Hamoushad. I'm originally from Algeria, and I call myself a researcher and activist. I'm currently the Arab Region Program Coordinator at the Transnational Institute, which is a research institution based in Amsterdam. And I work specifically around various issues, including the energy transition, extractivism, environmental and climate justice, food sovereignty with a focus on North Africa and at the Arab region. And I've been doing that kind of work in terms of research and activism through field work, through analysis, through writing, through political education activities, in the region, in the North African and Arab region. So for the last 10 years,
Wow.
Yeah. That's a little about me. In terms what made me a researcher and activist, and I think, yeah, that's a long trajectory. And I think our experiences coalesce together to make us who we are. But I can tell you a little bit how I came to become a researcher and activist in terms of environmental and climate justice. So I did a PhD actually in biology and the environment, and that's how I started getting interested in questions of the environment and the intersections between environment and health. But then during my student years, I was interested also in activism, civil society activism, yeah. With some Algerian friends in London. We started setting up an Algerian association for community purposes, to organize cultural activities and so forth. But then with the 2010-2011 Arab uprisings in the region, which were historical moments, epochal change at times, that inspired us to set up Algeria Solidarity Campaign and start campaigning for a democratization in our own country. But that kind of work connected us with other organizations and associations in the UK, including environmental and climate justice organizations, especially when there was another uprising in Algeria, which is the anti-fracking uprising in 2014 and 2015, which we followed very closely. We organized the rounds, did some protests here, have written some articles and analysis to highlight the resistance that was going on in southern Algeria against the fracking projects at the time. So that led me shift, you know, my field of work from biology and the environment into more environmental activism. So I joined some organizations like Platform London, Global Justice Now, where we were bringing the issues of human rights abuses and environmental crimes of the fossil fuel industries in various parts of the world. And I was focusing on Algeria, my home country. And then that led us to connect, at least led me to connect the dots between questions of democratization, socio-economic justice, but also environmental and climate justice. We launched a book at the World Social Forum back in 2015. Yeah. That was held in Tunis at the time. And the book was specifically on the coming revolution in North Africa, the struggle for climate justice. And then I started embarking on field research, doing field trips in various parts of North Africa, specifically Algeria, Tunisia, and Morocco. And I was exploring, or let's say, looking into socio-environmental conflicts in extractive sites, either mining, fossil fuels, or agribusiness. And I ended up publishing a few studies on extractivism and getting more interested in what is happening at the level of energy and renewable energy, because I saw that the same practices of dispossession, destruction, land grabbing that we see in fossil fuels and mining, we started seeing in the renewable energy projects in the region. And that's how I've become a researcher and activist. And for me, we cannot disconnect research from activism. We do research, we do analysis in order to change the world for the better, to analyze the dynamics so we can achieve, you know, justice in all its forms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is very interesting. I'm really impressed. So also, as you write in your book, it was not planned to first actually publish a book at the end. So how did you end up doing it and publishing your work?
So I think as like any other author, when at least in my case, I would say, let me focus on my case. I didn't just say with Katie, let's write this book. Let's go and write this book. No, it was a culmination of various experiences in the region, exchanges with other partners, other comrades, other colleagues, other organizations. It was built on different activities and events we organized with various partners, not just from the Arab region, but beyond. And in my case, I see it as a logical channeling of some of the ideas that I've been focusing on in the last decade, in terms of extractivist practices, in terms of accumulation of dispossession, in terms of social environmental conflicts we've seen in the region, in terms of the move towards renewable projects and the focus into export-oriented big mega projects that are geared towards providing, you know, the EU with its energy security. So it seemed that it was important to document the analysis, to document a level of exchange with partners, with people in the region, with activists, with scholars, and bring, you know, the voices from the region, or highlight and center the voices of the region, and link it into a kind of a coherent fruit, let's say, fruit of all these endeavors and efforts. So, like, if we look just at the short term, before publishing the book, the previous 3 years, like, we had a pandemic, we had many, many big events, but we started organizing on Zoom, actually. We organized a few activities where we brought scholars and activists from the region and from Europe and from other parts of the world as well, from Africa, to exchange around what a just transition would look like in North Africa, the Arab region. And so that was, you know, the first idea. But that first idea was also inspired by previous work inside TNI. Because before, in 2019, there was a meeting in Amsterdam where various organizations, including trade unions, indigenous communities, environmental organizations, met and fleshed out some of the principles of that just transition that we would like to see in the future. So you could say it's the culmination or the result of all these experiences intersecting with each other and documenting the wealth of knowledge that is being produced by activists and scholars in the fields. And we thought, no, we need to have that collection, and we need to have it in various languages. So that book actually is available in 4 languages so far. So it's English, French, Arabic, and Spanish.
Amazing, amazing. Yeah, this is, again, super interesting. And also, coming back to the just transition, in the beginning of your book, you talk about this just transition and environmental orientalism. And to now further dive into your book, so how are these two connected with each other, especially in the Arab region?
It's an important question, Sarah. I think it may take some time to flesh it out and highlight the connections between environmental orientalism and a just transition. But I feel that, first of all, we need to give an idea to the listeners. What do we mean by just transition, and what do we mean by environmental orientalism, before going into the intersection or the connections of these two concepts in the Arab region. So a just transition, in general terms, it is a transition from a system that is based on the exploitation of workers and communities and the destruction of environments to a more just and sustainable system built on regeneration, repair, respect for nature, but also free of exploitative relationships. And in that sense, this is a revolutionary project. And it doesn't just touch on energy or the environment or climate. It's also about a radical transformation of the socio-economic structures that generate impoverishment, that generates exploitation, that generates dispossession, and that generates wars. So it's not just about the environment or climate or energy. It's about the whole economy. And how do we democratize the current economy that works just for a tiny minority at the expense of the majority? We want a community that works for all, that does not commodify things, that is built on values of justice, dignity, freedom, sustainability, and respect And just from and to achieve that, you need to change the power imbalances at the local, national, regional, and international level. So it's about really radically transforming those power relationships, which means democratization at the local level, which means that the just transition project is an anti-colonial and anti-imperialist struggle. It is about class, which means it is an anti-capitalist struggle. It is also a feminist and an anti-racist struggle. So I think these are the main principle for a just transition. The book focuses on, of course, questions of climate and energy, but it touches on this overall picture. So just for the listener to get an idea what we mean by a just transition framework. And a just transition framework needs to put the working people at the heart of that project. Workers cannot be sacrificed in that transition to a better system, or the burden shouldn't be put on them. The wealthiest, the richest, the biggest polluters, the most advanced countries, the richest or wealthiest amongst us need to pay more in order to achieve that system. So that's just what we mean by just transition. In terms of environmental orientalism, this is actually, how can I say, built on the work of Edward Said. Edward Said wrote a lot on orientalism, so he wrote a well-known, very classic called Orientalism. And, you know, the orientalist framework, orientalism per se, is about the dominant forces in society, or the dominant powers of this world, which tends to be, you know, the global north or the Western powers, the most industrialized nation on earth, tend to misrepresent other peoples, their society, their culture, their economic structures, in racist, essentialist, condescending terms, in order to dominate them, to subjugate them, in order to push forward colonial projects and imperialist designs. That's what Orientalism in general, so it is a kind of racism towards Oriental people, represent them as backwards, as alien, as in need of the mission civilisatrice, the civilized mission, or the white man's burden. So this is Orientalism in general terms. When we talk about that, Orientalism can be reproduced not just at the level of discourses on culture or politics or economy, but also at the level of the environment. And actually, Diana Davis has done an amazing work in talking about the British Franco-colonial imaginaries about the environment in the Middle East and North Africa, and how the environment there during colonial times was represented as being defective, alien, exotic, often degraded, and in need of repair, improvement, restoration, which would mean that these colonial powers would need to intervene to repair it for their own interests. And usually those invite colonial racist, orientalist environmental narratives have been used to legitimize colonial dominations, have been used to legitimize plunder and dispossession of people of their land and natural resources. And actually, we are seeing the same thing being reproduced right now. These Orientalist deceptive representations of the environment in the region, in terms, first of all, being degraded, it needs repair, but also advancing other deceptive narratives, like the Sahara is empty, sparsely populated, representing this kind of, you know, El Dorado of cheap renewable energy for Europe. And And this narrative just obfuscates questions of property, sovereignty, that people live in those areas, what would happen to them when these big projects of renewable energy come. So in that sense, that environmental orientalism would represent a challenge for a just transition. So we're not just, you know, challenging neo-colonial or imperialist design at the political and economic level, but we need to also challenge them at the discursive level, at the way they represent the environment of people or people in general, and how these ploys, discursive ploys, are used to justify land grabs and dispossession, the theft of water, the use of resources, and also the externalization of socio-ecological forms. And we can maybe come back a little bit to this later, because there are a lot of projects that, like green hydrogen exports project, for example, in North Africa, they would need a lot of water. So in a way, you're creating new green sacrifice zones. You're taking away the water from the local people without asking them first if that's what they would like to do. So in general, I don't know if I painted a clear picture, Sarah, on how, you know, environmental orientalism is connected to just transition. So just transition need to center the local communities. The local communities know better about the environment and how they should be using their own resources, rather than this, you know, big companies or big powers or international financial institutions telling us what to do about our environments and how to better use the resources.
Yes. No, this was very understandable, I think. And I think it is also connected to other concepts that I found really interesting in your book, which are green colonialism and green grabbing. As you say, that that these narratives are used in green grabbing, for example, to kind of legitimize projects in renewable energy production, and that are, for example, solar panels or water dams. And how did you research in, for example, Morocco, you said, and Algeria, shed light on that development? Do you have maybe some examples?
Yeah, there are many examples. You know, we thought that the framing of green colonialism was very important in our studies, given, you know, the field work that we've done and the exchange of opinions and research and what we heard from our partners and comrades in the region. Colonialism is not that yet. It resurfaces in various ways, through, you know, other political and economic domination, through this kind of environmental colonial projects. So colonialism is still well alive. Some people prefer to use terms like neo-colonialism, and I use them myself to describe the new forms of colonialism, as it's not exactly as it was in the 19th century when Western colonial powers were occupying and controlling directly territories. Others prefer to use, you know, concepts like imperialism. And I think all of these are useful, and I use them myself. I use imperialism, green ecological imperialism, green colonialism, green neo-colonialism, and all of them have an analytical power, and we should use them context-based. Not everything is colonialism, not everything is grabbing, so we need to analyze the dynamics case by case. So the book documents many examples, Sarah, about green colonial projects or green colonial dynamics. So in cases of like Palestine, the occupied Golan Heights, which is a Syrian territory, and occupied by Israel, and Palestine. So Western Sahara, Golan Heights, Palestine, these are clear cases of green colonialism. And the colonial environmental narratives that I mentioned earlier is being used by the settler colonial state of Israel, has been used since its inception, saying we made the desert bloom. It was all Sahara and empty. And since the inception of this colony, Israeli colony, we made the desert bloom, it became paradise, and we are engaging in renewable energy projects, desalination water. And this is how Manal Shqayr, the Palestinian author in the book, was describing is greenwashing colonialism. And, you know, the more Israel entrenches its economic relationships, including in renewable energy and environmental projects, it normalizes its existence. It normalizes its settler colonial projects. And that's what Manal described as eco-normalization. Actually, it's an excellent chapter that I really, really recommend because it sheds a lot of light on these direct colonial dynamics. Western Sahara in Morocco is a similar case. Less violent, but it is an occupied territory by the Moroccan monarchy, which is building solar plants and wind farms on occupied land without the approval of, you know, the local population. Mm-hmm. So these are clearly green colonial projects because it entrenches Moroccan's domination and power on those territories and creates also links probably with other countries. If that green electricity is exported, for example, to other West African countries. So these are clear, direct green colonial projects. But then there are the export-oriented projects that are being pushed by foreign agendas. So they are not coming basically as local priorities, but they are coming from outside. From the European Union, from multinationals, from international financial institutions, from big funders, trying to push these projects because they are seeing the region as the El Dorado I described earlier. Huge surfaces of land, amazing solar potential, amazing wind potential as well. So why not take the opportunity and build those projects? Export energy to Europe. Europe does not have huge surfaces. It is a population dense, and then it has its own objectives in terms of reaching, you know, net zero by, I don't know, 2040, 2050, climate targets and so forth. So what these actors, powerful actors, are saying, why don't we externalize those projects and put, you know, the responsibility for our energy security and reach and climate targets on others. And for me, that is the main problem with those export-oriented projects. Because we need to bear in mind one thing. The North African or the Arab region in general is very climate vulnerable. And it is facing huge impacts of climate change right now. Drought, wildfires, recurrent heat waves, huge water poverty, floodings like we've seen in Libya last year, and that are, you know, creating huge disasters, costly disasters. So the priority for these countries and other countries in the global south should be climate adaptation, should be trying to find other sources of water in terms of water desalination, maybe changing the agricultural model so it consumes less water and produce for its own needs rather than virtually export water through exporting oranges, citrus fruits, tomatoes, and strawberries and watermelons. So I think this should be the priorities. But it seems that the priorities of the West or the global North in terms of climate mitigation, which means reducing CO2 emissions and moving to renewable energies, are being shifted, you know, through a spatial fix from north to south, saying, ah, these countries should be producing our renewable energies, without even thinking that maybe those projects should be filling the gap first in those countries. Maybe they should green their grids first, rather than thinking of an export agenda in the first place. But then these projects end up creating other problems. Of course, nothing is perfect. I can recognize this. But then people get dispossessed of their land. You create much more problems in terms of water when we talk about green hydrogen projects. And these are not taken into consideration. So we are seeing the reproduction of those colonial dynamics. So neo-colonial dynamics, we call them. So these are clearly, for me, green neo-colonial projects. And I didn't go into the ownership structure of those projects, because those projects are not owned by the communities and workers. They are owned by local and foreign capital, by local and foreign companies, who reap most of the profits, while the local communities do not get what they've been promised in terms of development projects, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of employment. In the contrary, some of these projects are losing money. And these, you know, are paid by the local coffers, which means more debt for these countries. So if we don't challenge that mentality, that logic, that colonial logic, extracting the resources, including the renewable energies, if we don't make equitable projects, if we don't change the nature of the trade in the relationships between North and South, we are gonna go into colonialism in the green era, which is basically green colonialism. And I don't know, I can give examples, Sarah, of these projects if you want. So right now, there is the Tunur project in Tunisia. They want to build a big solar plant to export energy. And in fact, there is another project that would facilitate the export, which is building an undersea cable that would connect Tunisia with Italy. Actually, that project is getting some funding from the World Bank, from the European Union, and from the Italians as well, because they want to get that green electricity from North Africa. And then you've got another project called X-Lynx. X-Lynx is an idea proposed by a big British investor. He was the ex-CEO of Tesco, a big supermarket in the UK, in collaboration with Aqua Power, a Saudi company. And they want to also build big solar plants, wind farms, to export electricity from southern Morocco to the UK. Export, direct export. They are not talking at all about local production. And they're going to use the same orientalist colonial environmental narrative. Those nets are empty, we're gonna create some jobs, it's a win-win situation. No, it's not. It's not. For a country like Morocco, to go much more concrete terms, Morocco, 20% of its electricity is produced from renewable energy. And it is one of the most advanced countries in the renewable energy sector in the region. So the other country, like Algeria, is just 1%. Less.
Oh yeah.
So wouldn't make sense, like, for Morocco, Algeria, or Tunisia to produce green electricity or green energy for their own use first before thinking of export. Yeah. These are the questions that the book tries to ask and focus
on. Definitely. This is very insightful and I think very important and very well written as well in the book, and explained how the local but also international kind of is in play with each other. And I'm interested in a bit more about this, again, this like just transition and the role of, for example, the European Union in the Arab region. So what is, if they are doing green grabbing and green colonialism, what would a just transition look like?
So yeah, as explained in the book and explained a little bit earlier, big powerful actors like the EU, the World Bank, the IMF, and other powerful development agencies like the GIZ, the German GIZ, USAID, French Cooperation, and others, you know, they are really active in terms of pushing a kind of an environmental, climate, and energy narrative in the region. They talk about renewable energy, they organize events, they publish reports in various languages, including in Arabic. But then their vision of that just transition, or that transition towards renewable energy, is biased and even dangerous, because it does not take into account questions of class, question of race, question of gender, question of power, question of colonial history. It does not talk about justice to court. Even if they use the terms just transition, they do not talk about justice. Their vision is about privatization of everything, privatization of the commons, privatization of land, privatization of water, energy, and even the atmosphere. We have now these carbon credits. We've been having them actually for almost 3 decades now as a solution to the climate crisis. And in a way, it's commodified everything and trying to make profit out of it. They do not talk about climate reparations. They do not talk about the environmental crimes of big, you know, fossil fuel companies. So their vision is, as I said, it is dangerous. And it's about more subjugation, more domination, it's about more accumulation by dispossession. And it's about grabbing at the resources. And the EU has been doing that. When you look just at the time of the war in Ukraine with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, suddenly all the plans around, you know, climate targets, CO2, reduction of CO2 emissions were thrown in the bin. They said we need to shift away from Putin, from the dictator Putin, and go to others. That's what they've done with the military dictatorship in Algeria. That's what they've done with the military dictatorship in Egypt. That's what they've done with the settler colonial state of Israel. That's what we've done with the authoritarian state of Qatar, to get more gas from these countries. And the Italians did the same thing with the Algerians. So the Algerians have been pumping more gas to Italy and Europe this year and the next. And then in terms of what they are planning to do in green hydrogen, they said, okay, we need to move more to green hydrogen. They quadrupled their targets from 5 million tons to 20 million tons by 2030. And half of that, which means 10 million tons, needs to be imported. Imported from where? Guess. And mainly North Africa. And other countries as well, because especially Germany is looking to diversify, looking at Namibia, South Africa. But since North Africa is close and it has a big renewable energy potential, and there is some kind of transport infrastructures in terms of shipping and pipelines, so it's the right place. But nobody tells you how the surfaces that are needed for these kind of projects. Like in southern Morocco, in Guelmim, there is a project proposed by Total, which is a subsidiary of the French company Total, for doing green hydrogen projects. I looked at the surface that they would like to build all their stuff on, and it is around 180,000 hectares. And I had to look at what that means. I wanted to compare with how much is it. It's more than the surface of the London area.
Wow.
The they don't tell you about the water question. Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria suffer from huge droughts. They have water crisis. So the water desalination should be going into drinking and local agriculture rather than for these green, because green hydrogen necessitates water. You break the molecule of water. We didn't explain that, but it necessitates huge amounts of water. So why would we prioritize export-oriented green hydrogen projects? So the EU safeguards its own energy security and reaches its own climate targets. This is a challenge. So that's why we need to challenge these projects. We need to highlight them. We need to name and shame, you know, the companies and the people involved. But also, Sarah, we shouldn't just be blaming, you know, the North and the West, because the local ruling classes are benefiting from these projects. You know, they are benefiting. Local capital is always in conjunction or in collaboration with foreign capital. They are benefiting. So that's why the question of democratization, and I always come back to it, you know, we need to democratize political and economic systems. We need to talk about sovereignty. And it's not just national sovereignty. It's also popular sovereignty. Our land, water, natural resources. People and working people need to be involved in this project. As long as they are excluded, the European Union can deal with the ruling classes in those countries. And, you know, everyone would be a winner in terms of the ruling classes. But the people, they will be sacrificed. Their environment will be sacrificed. Their water will be sacrificed. And I can say a lot of other stuff around this, because European companies are involved in all these projects, and their profits are guaranteed. And why? If there is a risk in those projects, the risk should be shared. Why are we always putting, you know, the risks and the costs to the peripheries of that system, and then up creating, you know, new sacrifice zone?
I think this is also very well shown in your book, that the distinction of who owns what, who decides what, and also what do they do with it, like these crucial political economy questions. We're almost out of time, but I really would like to know what you're working on now and how your future projects are looking like.
Yeah, so there are always a lot of projects. I'm busy. No, but you're right. The book tries at least push those key political economy questions. Who owns what? Who gets what? Who does what? Who wins and who loses? And in whose benefit are those projects are constructed? And I think this is a plea that we are making to scholars and activists and researchers to always put at the center of their work, to look at these projects in terms of those questions, to identify the actors, the agents of change, the losers, the winners. And doing that, you're going to document the dynamics of capital. What is capital doing in the environmental sphere, in the green spheres, in renewable energy? Are we going to just reproduce the same colonial, capitalist, parasitic, extractivist dynamics? Or are we trying to do better? I feel that we would like to do better. We would like to move towards a more sustainable and just system, because green capitalism is not about greening. No, it's about making profits in the name of being green. It's just greenwashed capitalism. It's just the same dynamics. They're going to create more issues, more problems, if we continue the same consumption and production intensive patterns in the West and in some rich pockets in the global South. We would need more resources. And in here you have the critical raw material things that we need to build, you know, called batteries, the solar panels, the wind turbines, and so forth. We need a lot of resources. So we're going to destruct more environments. We're going to create more sacrifice zones. So we need to ask these questions. And that book is not just relevant for the Arab region. It takes the Arab region as a case study, yes, but it has a global relevance because the lessons that can be learned from there in terms of neocolonial dynamics, in terms of commodification, in terms of privatizations, in terms of the involvement of international neoliberal actors like the World Bank and IMF, and in terms of how people are resisting and proposing. And I think these lessons can be learned, but also the region, as we know, is a key nodal point of global fossil fuel capitalism in terms of the Gulf and other rich fossil fuel countries like Iraq, Libya, and Algeria. So the region cannot be ignored in terms of global discussions of phasing out fossil fuels and moving away to other stuff. I just wanted to say this before I tell you what I'm doing this year. So I'll be busy promoting this book, Sarah. Actually, as I said, it is in four languages. So I'd be doing a lot of events and book discussions and activities in the Arab world. Actually, I'm going to Cairo in 2 weeks' time and then to Beirut in a month. Mm-hmm. And then I'll go to Tunisia in May. So there will be a lot of events in the Arab region to try to push the argument and create debate, because that's the idea of the book. Mm-hmm. Initiate debate and discussion. Start thinking about those issues. Because the book is not comprehensive. It cannot cover everything. So there are some lacunas, there are some blind spots there that we need to build on. And then I'm doing, a book tour in the US. And I'm hoping to do some events, probably in South Africa at some point. But then in terms of publications, I'm looking more into questions of climate reparations, but also what a green and just industrialization policy would look like in countries in North Africa. So these are a lot of projects. I hope I'll get the time and do at least some of them.
Very nice, very nice. This is very exciting. Thank you so much, Hamza, for your profound and thought through answers, giving us an insight into your new book. I wish you all the best. This was a podcast in the New Books Network about the book Dismantling Green Colonialism. I'm your host, Sarah Vogelsanger, and I hope you will join next time again.